This is lecture number one of A Day with John McMaster, Sunset Room, Ambassador Hotel, Los Angeles, September 20th, 1970, entitled Freedom, with introductory remarks by Jack Horner. Copies are available from the Association of International Dianologists, 1700 Westwood Boulevard, Westwood Village, California, 90024, area code 213-474-1565.
Well, it's nice to welcome you here in Los Angeles on this nice September morning, a nice Sunday. It's my particular pleasure to have you here and to share with you a day with John McMaster. Now, my name is Jack Horner, and this morning we're at least not in the corner. Someone always says that, so I might as well. But I think I'd like to say something in a way about courage. All of you are here because you've got courage. You had the courage to be interested in man, in his potential, in yourself, and in yours. The courage to look, to find out, to want to know more, to want to express more completely, whatever your particular personal purposes were and are. And I know many of you have investigated many fields and will continue to probably investigate many more. A great many of us, as you know, were involved for many years in a subject called Dianetics and Scientology, which brought to us an adventure, at least, and some experiences that I think life might have been rather dull without. And furthermore, I think most of us got a way of looking at things and some understandings that might have been more difficult to obtain in another way. And for whatever reasons, personally or otherwise, we left because the format became more important than the purpose or whatever. For whatever the undesirable size of it may have been, many of us couldn't or can't deny the gains and benefits we personally obtained. There's a time to go on. It's perhaps a time to graduate. I hope it shouldn't have to be a school and you stay in forever. But in any event, some of us found that the particular form we couldn't work with, and for example, this is why I started something called Dianology, of which I'm fortunately in a position to have many sources other than myself. And speaking for myself, I'm drawing upon the whole universe and have help from all of you to make it possible. Nonetheless, today, your being here is an expression of courage. Many of us have had very personalized threats to our lives and to our existence. In this last year, I've been amazed at the number of people who have been utterly terrified to even perhaps talk to me because of what might happen, because they were so afraid of losing the only way to total freedom. In Dianology, we try to provide an alternative, at least one. And as John might say, we're more interested in infinite freedom and total freedom. Perhaps he'll say more about that. Anyway, I was talking to John about what I might say about him. I don't think I had to say a great deal, but we met at St. Hill for the first time. Now, I should say John is probably, we were discussing how to introduce him, he could probably be considered Scientology's longest reigning clear. A few years ago in a PAB, Hubbard said, I've been clear many times. I got an old bracelet or two around. Bracelets are very representative of slavery. But in any event, this marvelous man, when I first met him at St. Hill, the thing that I want you to know about John McMaster's, it's a big secret, is that he was a marvelous man in the first place. And he's going to shoot me if I keep putting the S on the end of his name. But he has brought a tremendous amount of interest, ability, purpose. He's revitalized people's ideas and purposes and desire to move ahead for themselves. And I know many of you have benefited personally just by his existence, as I'm sure many thousands of others will continue to do. And he's appeared all over the world as Scientology's clear number one, has talked to presidents and diplomats and statesmen. He's talked to thousands and thousands of people. He knows mankind very well. Both of us, by the way, have traveled over most of this planet and know a lot about the human beings of this planet and some of the things they feel and they desire and they want. And John has a particular ability to tune in on this, to know you, and maybe point a direction to look. And he has a way of expressing love and affinity and a long vitale that is unique. And I think that he has shown a tremendous amount of courage to stand by his principles, his own knowingness, to do what he has done, and to truly be free. And so with that particular statement, it's my very great pleasure to introduce to you John McMaster.
Thank you very much, Jack, for introducing me. And I'd like to thank you all so much just for wanting me. There was a sort of, in the family and the business at home in South Africa, there was a little bit of, but you can't go. And then finally my mother said to me, well, I don't see how you could resist such a reach. So then just everything changed and it was quite easy to come. But it's very nice for me, you know, to have moved off from a particular sort of constant activity of being with people, seeing people, and in a way connecting with people in the nicest way I know. And sort of to have got myself back to South Africa, which is right the other end, and the only time that I could connect with all the people I had connected with was when I took time out to go and sit totally alone and just put in the telepathic lines again. And it became easier and easier for me to do it because I had no intention ever of disconnecting. You see, there are so many gradients to existence. Like there is, this is my life. Each one of you can say that. And have you ever heard Amanda Ambrose singing, "This is my life," you know, and what she puts into it? Well, this is my life, and for each one of us, you know, I've sort of put it in the same way. It's my life. I can give it away, but if I give it away, I must do it with that sort of responsibility that I trap no one. Because if I allow people to take my life, say, in various ways, and there are many ways of taking a life other than just destroying a body, if I allow that to happen, I am committing the greater crime. Because, as you may or may not know, it is worse to be sinned against than to sin, because you trap the person who sins against you, and he is stuck with you forever. Now, I didn't ever want that sort of thing to happen, and I did feel that I knew better than to have it happen. Nevertheless, it required constant policing of my activities and my whether I was motivating or nattering or being silly or whatever. So, it came to a point last year when a technology that still is very much a part of my spiritual backbone, because I have used it and found it always to work. It was the one thing that helped me to, say, fulfill at least one of the purposes of my being on the planet at this time. And so I can't turn around and kick it in the teeth and say that it isn't so anymore. Because it is very much so. That was very, very real. And it always will be. But I didn't see why, when you take a technology and you use it, that I should therefore have to, say, be compelled to sit under an administrative structure, which to me was destroying the technology rather than, say, enhancing it. Like, if you created an administrative structure here, it is a form and it is basically a dead thing. Now, all of a sudden, spontaneously, a minute later, a year later, 5 years later, 10 years later, whatever, you have a burst of free people. People who've all become clear, or whatever you would like to call it. People whose knowing and understanding and having intolerance of each other is so much, so infinitely greater than it was at that time. And then you say to them, but now you are still less than this administrative structure. Then you are doing something which to me is what has denied man his right to freedom right from the beginning of time. And that is, the creation of a form becomes greater than the creator of it. You see, so then you get form, the static thing, the unanimated thing, being made senior to function, you, the doer. And as soon as you get that happening, you get the whole mechanism of suppression and the dwindling spiral right down until ultimately you just get the total solidity. If the being continues to accept that form is greater than function, he can only go one way, and that's done. Now, I'm not after revolution. I don't, you see, when I was challenged in South Africa, and I had been challenged a little bit about my action, which I'll tell you a little bit more about, I said, I will never stand up and speak again to people then. Never. Until I can say that which will cause no recrimination, no bitterness, no motivation. Because no matter what goes on in the planet, no matter how it might seem, nothing is really good or bad, except as you will see it. And so long as whatever you have experienced, you have learnt from, then you have power and you have knowledge. And one day I wrote a poem just out of the blue, and I suddenly realized that, you know, love and power maybe are akin. Because power is something totally the other end of the scale from force. And therefore, the more love, the more power. And suddenly, it's like I knew, I'm not saying whether I was right or wrong, but in that moment I knew for me that love is power. So, looking at it, I thought, well, I haven't got any less love. My love's been growing and growing and growing. But if I subordinated myself to what I considered at that time spiritual tyranny, I would have been trapping not only me, but everyone, and it amounts to millions now through the television shows and things like that, everyone I had ever connected to. See, I would have been pulling them into what I was accepting. So therefore, it was something that needed to be looked at. And I then had to function instead of just agreeing to be part of a form. Because, as I say, this is my life. And no one, you know, has the right to tell me when I keep evolving and evolving and evolving, no one has the right to say, ah, it doesn't matter how free you are or how you see things, you must still see them this way. And the point Jack made about total freedom, I don't want total freedom. No one will tell me that there is a totality to freedom. Because if I buy it, 2 + 2 = 4, the guy can say, you have got your total, now you still listen to me. And I am still susceptible to being circuitized. Now, you know, it's a word that I just coined for myself, but I think it expresses what I'm talking about. Because as I looked, I sat in New York and I thought, I cannot pretend any longer. You know, I have gone out, I say, exposed myself to people, but I found that was no risk because people were beautiful, people were good, people never wanted to hurt me and I didn't want to hurt them. And you see, through, say, working with Scientology and so on, I was able to discover the magic of me and the magic of people and what people are really like, even though they're playing these games up here of apparently hurting each other and so on. All around, above that and below it and all around, is the being who's not like that at all, really. So if you can create a safe space, just create a safe space and observe what a person does, you will see the guy begins spontaneously to become creative in a way that he's not afraid of showing it any longer. So in Scientology, you had, say, these conditions which go power, affluence, normal operation, emergency, danger, non-existence, liability, doubt, enemy, treason. Right, now treason is the bottom one, which is a condition of betrayal after trust. Now many people in Scientology have been declared in a condition below treason, but it's never been named. Now last year, when I was working a lot with the United Nations and governors and people like that, I was watching something, you see, that goes on, something that's common to all the human race. And I thought, that's that condition that's never shall be nameless, you see. And I thought, why on earth should it be nameless? And I'll tell you how suddenly and spontaneously it hit me. I had, Mario Fenninger was you know of Mario, the pianist. Well, Mario and I are friends. And I hope that he will not allow any form to prevent us from continuing to be friends. Anyway, he came to New York and I was there and I was a class 8 and he was a class 8 and suddenly he was alone and adrift and it's like he felt he was out on an asteroid and he wasn't quite sure whether his auditing, because he was doing a lot of private auditing, whether it was satisfactory or not, and he was beginning to go into doubt about his auditing. So he called me and asked me if I'd please come and sit in on his auditing sessions. So I said, certainly. So I went and I sat in there and I watched him auditing people on the triple flows and I watched him auditing people right up to power. When he'd finished, I said to him, there's nothing wrong with your auditing at all. Just keep on with it. It's fine. So he said, oh, marvelous. So for 4 days, he audited like a dream and everything went well. And then one day, he phoned me and again, he was saying, oh, he just had to see me again. So I said, all right. But it was happened to be a day that I was very busy. I was going to a civil liberties cocktail party with Tony Randall and Melvin Douglas and Mrs. Melvin Douglas. Then from there I was going to have dinner with a Swedish actor at 9 o'clock, and then from then I was going to one of the Scientology centers at midnight because they wanted me to come and help them sort out something. And so I said to Mario, well, any time after that, if that suits you, that's when you can see me. So he said, fine. So at about 3 o'clock in the morning I knocked on his door in the Bolivar Hotel just near Central Park. And He had gone to bed, but he had got out of bed, and then he got into bed when I arrived. And I said, oh, well, I'm a bit thirsty now. And I had kept a bottle of bourbon in his fridge, you see. So I went and poured myself a drink and came back and sat on his dressing table and said, now, what the hell is the matter with you this time? So he says, John, it's my auditing. So suddenly, I said to him, you're in a condition below treason. And then he says, oh, what do you mean? I said, you're in a condition of betrayal after knowing. Not after trusting, after knowing. He said, what do you mean? So I said, 3 days ago, you knew you could audit. 2 days ago, you knew you could audit. Yesterday, you knew you could audit. But today, you decided you couldn't. So what have you done? You've betrayed your own knowing of you. He said, ah, that was fine. So, he said, well, how do I get out of this? So I said, create a safe space. So that you can know you know. And you know, it was quite incredible, the change that took place. But you see, if you are going up this way, you go up through believing, having faith in, trusting, and so on, until eventually you know. Now, once you know, and you pretend that you still have to have faith in, well, you're betraying yourself and you're betraying everyone else too. You see. Now, when you're coming down on the inversion, it goes the other way around. So there's betrayal after trust, which is treason, and then there's betrayal after knowing, which is the one down below. So the only way to get out of anything is to be safe enough to really look at it and see. You see, otherwise you don't know what you're trying to get out of. If you're not safe, you can't really see. You're looking through all sorts of other considerations of anxiety, fear, you know, odd rudiments of some sort. So, these are things, you know, that require to be looked at. Now, it was very interesting. I thought, well, what sort of formula would one use to create a safe space? So I thought, well, the first thing, obviously, is to really look at what is there. And if it's concerning another, look at another and observe. And some way or another, find out what that person's you know, most easy findoutable purpose is. What do they want to do? What's the purpose? You see, and then observe it and just watch until that person actually performs an action on his own purpose and immediately validate that person. But you mustn't validate everything he's doing, because quite a lot of the things are off purpose. That's why he's unsafe. But the moment he does something that's on purpose, validate him, and suddenly there's integrity, and there's safety, there's recognition, there's duplication, there's everything that goes together to make a safe space. And the guy knows that he has been observed and he really has a friend. So suddenly there you have the creation of a safe space. So when I'd worked all of this out, I thought, you're a clever Johnny. So I wrote it all out, and I sent one copy to Ron Hubbard, and I sent another copy to Richard Nixon. And what I want to tell you, I didn't get an acknowledgement. I don't know whether Ron ever received it. I never got an acknowledgement from him. But I got a very beautiful letter from Richard Nixon, thanking me very much for this important, what he considered valuable data that was going into his reference library, and he would be using it. So, you know, thank you. It wasn't a matter of trying to be clever. It's like suddenly you've seen something, and you have like an urgency when you see a man's being put in a post as president, and the poor guy's got to take over the responsibilities of all the artnesses that went before, and he is suddenly now the cause of a war that was started before he even got there, and he's the cause of this, and he's the cause of that, and now you've got to pick up all the loose ends of unsolved things. And he's right fixed. Now, what do you want to do? You want to help create a safe space for him so that he can see which is which and put the right ends together. Not keep shooting at him and targeting him and targeting him until he's more and more unsafe and will make more and more mistakes. The people tend, when they get to those positions, to lose sight of the fact that the people are the power. Each one of you who has the right to say, this is my life, nevertheless is individually part of the power of a nation. There is no government that has any power without its people. But they tend to lose sight of this. And the people lose sight of it too. So if the people keep flowing towards that which they have elected to help them become happy and safe, then it makes these people safer and safer and safer. So you observe them too. Observe President Nixon, and you know that he has at least a purpose that the American people shall be happier, and that the American people's relations with the world outside shall be smoother, more harmonious and calmer. You know that at least that is one of his purposes. Then every time he takes an action that is on one of those purposes, you immediately validate him. You watch what will happen. It's like it is our responsibility, you know. We who are the power of earth, whatever we like, whichever way we like to look at it. We might like to say, I want to go up in the mountains because I prefer the trees to people. Well, that's a slight distortion of evaluation of importances, because obviously people are the power of the earth, and as they look and discover more and more about themselves, they will find that in actual fact they are the creators of all things. See, now this is the potential of man. It's what man has always been, but in the game that man is playing, he tends to occlude this from himself. for some reason or another. Because we have got mocked up all sorts of deities down through the thousands and thousands of years. You know, from just big types of men with funny-looking faces and things put on their head, various types of what we would call savage people, but whether they are or not is another matter, have worshipped as God, like the anthropomorphic concept, you know, that it's just a bigger thing than man. And man has made, God has made man in his own image, and there, meanwhile, man is busy making God in his own image, because deep down underneath, man knows what he really is. And he knows that God can't be anything more than what he basically is in a bigger thing, if there is such a thing as a bigger spirit, you see. Or is the God, in actual fact, the accumulation of all the, you know, the beingness of all of us? You see, now, I'm not asking you to believe a word I say here, but it's like concepts of deities, of gods, have been thrown out to man for so long, and man has bought it for a certain length of time, and he moves on, he gets impatient, he thinks that can't be it. Thinks it can't be it, and then he changes, but he doesn't actually look back and think, have I totally erased the fact that I was stuck on that God before? And maybe he hasn't totally erased that, but he just goes on, and so you've got untidy ends sitting behind. And he's never quite free to find himself as God, because there's one thing that has become so real to me, that the Messiah you seek is you. And the Messiah that man is always seeking is himself, herself. Itself, whatever you like. And this is a tremendous thing, you know, to really own and know, because you've got to move through this and know. Because to begin with, somebody will say, my God, he's full of himself, an opinionated monster, and self-opinionated monster, and so on. It is not so. You see, one must look and see you know, how things come into existence. So it's so simple, really. We've got data, it's all around us. No man is the source of truth. No man ever has been, and no man ever will be. And I think this is one of the reasons why Ron Hubbard has had such a fantastic amount of trouble. Because people have tried to set him up as the source of truth. And he is not. And of course, man knows he is not. And so man, on just an automaticity, rejects the idea that one man is the source of truth. Because truth has been floating in the ether since whenever, available for whoever wants it any time. And the fact that people decide to start philosophies or ologies or whatever, in order to put stepping stones towards the alignment of data that will ultimately produce truth, well, so long as people are wanting to do this, this is marvelous, because the truth has become slightly dispersed. You see, and you do need some sort of organized system with which to catch the little bits again and put them together. But one doesn't have to make a huge, big banquet out of all of that until eventually the ology becomes more important than you. Always it is you who do it. The ology is inanimate, it is dead, it can do nothing. Now, when a person writes a book and says, Scientology does this, it is off source. There is a trap there. Because Scientology does nothing, you do it. When a person writes a book and even says, Dianology does this, or even says, Dianetics does this, no, you do it. And you will use that technology to take yourself as far as you wish to go. And I have looked at the technology of Dianology, and I think it is fine for what my consideration of it is. Because I can see with that technology there's infinite potential for anyone who wants to take it. You can grow wings and fly. You see now, for instance, with the... You get quite a surprise. Ron Hubbard said to me, when I was the only clear at that time, he said, well, you, John McMaster, you could have gone clear on anything. Therefore, I cannot be clear until I know that I have built the bridge whereby every last one can go to freedom. And to me, that was a perfectly acceptable and very, very marvelous statement, you see. But there is the answer. When people start talking about the only route to clear, I know what Ron Hubbard himself said to me. You could have gone clear on anything, but that doesn't guarantee to me that I have built that bridge along which every last one will be able to go clear. There's no feathers in my cap. I was excited about what I was doing, and I didn't care if they were asking me, what are you willing to talk to me about? I would have run where I wanted to run. You know, I wouldn't have been told, you can't say this in this, you can't say that till you're 86. It's like a... I never tried to make an auditor unsafe, because that was the vital thing, to have my auditor safe enough to receive me. But on the other hand, I wasn't going to let them commit that overt by which I would trap them if they were telling me what I may or may not say in my own session. And it might sound selfish, but I'm glad I did it the way I did it, because I can say now, this is my life. You know, it really is my life. And I don't wish to intrude it on anyone else's. And I don't want people to wander around like being a whole lot of other types of John McMaster. It's the last thing on earth, because then we'd have no game either. You know, each one must be what each one wishes to be. And just move on into this whole infinite increasing awareness of things. And so you get these quiet little things, like, which I have asked to be reformed from Scientology and Dianetics, because I still consider them very, very valuable, you know, technologies for man to take and use. And it's like saying it's the only way. You know, enforcing, you know, ghastly evaluations by people who can't even observe themselves, looking at another and saying, you're an enemy. And if, because the ethics officer sits darting another, he says the other one's in doubt. Can you see this? You see, now, to have that sort of thing working hand in hand with a technology that could do so, that you could do so much for yourselves with, well, it kills it, because this is what happens. You come up here, boom. You know, you make a new state of release. And there it is. And you look at it, and you marvel. And somebody says, ha, this is administration, you see now. You're still in a condition of something. So the guy makes another state of release. Then the ethics, another state of release, ethics, another state of release, ethics, another state of release, ethics. And finally, when I sat in New York, I thought, well, they've declared just about every clear up to the second clear so far in something. So I'll stick my neck out, I'll take this action and see whether they will declare me a suppressive person. Because I'm quite prepared to be declared a suppressive person if I am. I'd rather like it. Because I certainly don't want to go walking around in a state of delusion about me. On the other hand, I'd much rather discover it myself. And I would like everyone to have the right to discover that himself or herself, because if you look at it, qualifications division is the division of correction. The conditions and the formulae with which you apply them are correction. They therefore belong in the division of qualifications, in the department of review, and not in the hands of some primitive ethics officer. I mean this because I have seen invariably the people who get into the positions of ethics officers are the people who know least about the technology, care least about the evolution of mankind, and just love wielding this thing as a weapon, instead of presenting it always as a tool. It's so lovely if you do it this way. You see, this again is the tyranny of form over function. There's the delight in putting a person into a condition, or the glee, I should say. And then when the person's in that condition, now you've made him less than a form, because the condition is a form. And they make it even more important than saying to the guy, here is the formula, which is the function, see? Now, if you did it this way, there's a guy who's being a bit unhappy, or he's not succeeding on his post, or so for some reason or another, and you just call him over and say, come, take him into the qualifications division, to the director of review, and say, and the director of review says, come and have a look at this. Here are all these formulae. Which one do you think you could apply now so that you'd feel better? Just read them and tell me. And he goes through them and he says, oh, I better find out that I am, I suppose. And instantly he's got it for himself, you see. And you say to him, all right, how do you feel now? He says, oh, I feel so much better. I say, well, which one could you apply now? And I'll bet you it's not the next one up. The next one he feels like applying is the power one. Because when you get to the basic of the real basic, which a guy will find for himself, and only he knows, no matter how smart the rest of us might think we are, only that guy sitting over there knows his facts, you see. So he must find it for himself, and he'll do it much faster than you will. Because the great danger of that ethics structure whereby somebody else evaluates for another is that if the guy happens to have some altitude or respect for you, And he's not in that condition you've put him in. He's going to dramatize it. Because he has respect for you. So you dramatize it so you see what you've caused. A whole lot of circuitry. Anyway, I'm just talking around these things because I do not think that they will ever exist in Dianology from what I have seen. These are the types of things that Scientology would be wonderful without. No, it would, because it is such a pity to see something that was created for the purpose it was created, you know, with such a fabulous technology, being sort of overshadowed with this other thing that sort of like it doesn't want, it's almost as if the technology is there and you can use it to get free, but suddenly as people were getting free, and apparently there was a threat that they might not conform any longer, then you had to be quite sure that you had the weapons there with which to compel conformation. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah.
And that is unnecessary, because what did you set out to get the guy, to say to him, look, I'm going to give you freedom, I'm going to help you to find your own freedom, to work towards it and find it. You see, you say this to him, and he gets it. And now he says, I want to dance. And you say, but that's against the law. Or something like that. And he says, well, what the hell did I work for? You say, insubordination, you're an enemy. But what you're an enemy to, heaven only knows. You've just discovered yourself for the first time. But these, you know, what I'm saying in over all of this is simply the tremendous unseeing threat with which man, in his, I suppose, gentle loveliness overall, gradually allows himself to become less than the something that is created and the creation of another. And man constantly feeling that he has to have a leader. Somebody said this to me the other night, and I was so thrilled to hear it, because I've been saying at home in South Africa, you see, they've said, you have to be a leader, you have to start your own movement. And I said, I don't want to be a leader. I want only to communicate to man so long as I can be getting man more and more to see that he is not that badly off that he needs any sort of leader. He can find it out for himself. And then they can agree that this one will do the governing of that, and that one will do the governing of that, and that one will do the governing of that, and everyone will be in a state of, you know, tremendous sort of reciprocity of equality, which is what, you know, is part of your constitution anyway, you know, the equality of man. Well, gradually man slips away from that. And something or another, it's not man's laziness, you know, or man's irresponsibility, or any of these things. It's like he never feels quite safe enough to inspect the possibility of this thing called the equality of man. And then he goes into revolution about it. And of course the revolution tends to make leaders again, because this guy stands up and does all the talking and circuitrizes the others, and they all run like one to go and revolt. And so you see, this, it's like an implant or a wrongness that came in long, long ago, that it's right to have leaders. Because then there isn't so much chance of your being wrong if the leader makes the decision. You see, it's like all these sorts of nuances as to how this may or may not have come into existence. Now, I do not know all, by a hell of a long chalk. But this is what I'm looking at. How can I communicate to man so man will begin to look along these lines and realize that he's not badly off, that he's not that badly off, that he is compelled to be led always, that he can, in actual fact, get up and say, this is my life, and I can let you have your life, and we can all live together. And we can still create that sort of system that never can ever again sit above us. Because so long as one has the concept that you must have a leader, and you must have the gradient of leaders, so gradually you build the pyramid, and then even when there are no people there, the structure sits, and the structure is greater than you are. Now this, you see, Ron said in his last journal, the journal of 1968, we must not make the same mistake that they made with Christianity. We mustn't make that mistake. So I looked at this and I thought, well, that's something I will use, because what mistake did they make with Christianity? Well, the mistake they made with Christianity is that they made it greater than the living being. And that is exactly the mistake, and I lectured here in Los Angeles and around the United States last year in most of the organizations a lecture on that point. Please don't make Scientology greater than the living being. Please don't do it. Because then, not only will you destroy the being, but theology will become worthless. And then man will suddenly just explode with fury, and it's gone, and you've got another revolution, which is totally unnecessary. And instead of just the gentle, no matter at what velocity you move, the evolution, rather than revolution, the evolution can always be gentle. You can move at a fantastic velocity and always have this gentle evolution going along, where there's not only agreement, there are more things required than just agreement, but people's tolerance of each other, people's having of each other. Like, we're evolving and we see the same data, but we don't necessarily see it the same way, and we don't necessarily want to use it the same way. And if I want to use it in my creative way and you want to use it in your creative way, it doesn't mean to say we've got to keep walking along that same path. We are moving towards, say, an ultimate. But at that ultimate, why shouldn't we all arrive? You know, not just as identical somethings, but with the awareness of infinite truth, or truth as it is, plus all of you that's worth bringing. You know, your own feelings, your own creations, your own ideas, your whatever it is that you want. I can see no reason why in a state of infinite truth man cannot have what man will have, you know, or spirit cannot have what spirit will have. Like, somewhere along the line we've got a concept. Like, somewhere there's an ocean where we'll all finish up and we'll all be identical and we'll all be in this thing called truth. I don't know, does it seem like that to you sometimes? To me it seems like that. And then we're just looking at it, and I think, well, why shouldn't you arrive there the way you wish to arrive there? And why shouldn't I arrive there the way I wish to arrive there? It's not a matter of being an individualist or anything else. It's like, maybe we'll all be better off if we can arrive there, not like a lot of strangely circuitized robots, you know, that are told that this is the only way and that's the way you've got to do it and that's the way you're going to be. Why can't you come with your garlands of flowers, your, you know, string of racehorses, or whatever else you want to bring with you? You see, it's like, why does one have to, you know, agree that now that's that dynamic and that's that dynamic and that's that dynamic, and really, you know, it's rather silly to be interested in those sorts of things when you can be interested in just going straight along there and just ending up in the state of infinite truth. What I'm saying, I hope, is not sort of coming out as criticism of something, because people must be free to talk and talk and talk until they can put into words exactly what they see. And they must not be told every time that they want to talk that they've got to go along and pay $25 for a review, because that's the only place where you can talk. Obviously, it's fine to be able to do that, to have an auditor. See, but for instance, if I want some help on something I'm looking at, like I got it yesterday, it was rather interesting. This guy, who was a radio interviewer, who was a charming person. I don't know what time it's being played today, but it was really a marvelous interview. It's the highest toned interview I've ever had. And this chap was sitting there, and I was looking, and he was asking me, he asked me the question, do they have to pay for Dianology processing and training? And I said, well, yes, they do, because obviously money is a necessary commodity at this particular stage, and you've got to pay rental for these things, and their family's got to eat, and you know, it's as obvious that one has to pay. But Jack Horner is trying to get a costing system whereby he can reach a maximum number of people at a minimum cost, so that everyone shall be able to get it, and he will be able to live. He won't have to walk around in sacks, you see. And the rest of you who work on it will be able to live too. So then he went on saying, how did I feel about money and this? And I said, well, I've never quite reconciled it. You know, being asked the question directly, I've always handled it before, but I have never quite reconciled it the way it suited me. And so I was busy, and I stumble a little bit as I'm listening, and he's sitting there, and he's had me so beautifully, and the space was so safe, that suddenly I got it. This is what has always bothered me. There is truth, you see. Now, you can't get it unless you pay in advance. <I see. laughs> And this has bothered me tremendously, and I never really asked why. Until yesterday, on this little radio show, I suddenly got it. It's because, in actual fact, truth is being made less than money. And money is only man's invention as a yardstick of exchange. And all of that which is truth is being valued as less than this. If you haven't got this commodity, this money, you can't have that. And that's, I've never looked at it just like that before. Then what I was really underneath growling about was that money was being made more than, you know, the individuality of man reaching for and finding truth. Thank you. So, it's like suddenly I said to him, well, that's the typical example of what an auditor would do with a pre-clear. You just created a space safe enough for me to be able to sit here, talk to you, stumble a little bit until suddenly I aligned what it was I was looking for. A little lost thing that I'd put out on a limb, because I was sort of tending to not is it, because you know, you always get asked about Scientology and money every time you go on a radio show or every time you go on a television show. Why do they charge? And then no one else charges. Because there are many ways of charging. Like you can say Christianity doesn't charge, but it's rather funny that they're one of the wealthiest institutions in the world. Now, you know, there's direct charging by saying we are confident that we can produce that state of release, and so the price is so much. And so you're out in the open and you say, we know we can do it. In the other case, if you're not sure that you can do it, you simply say, well, would you like to support us until such time as we find out, you know, what we can do for you? And then, you know, you're still paying anyway. And then there's a more subtle side of, well, you know, there's the gates of heaven you've got to get through. And, you know, depending on what you've done down here to support us, maybe you won't get through those gates. You know, and there are all sorts of subtle ways of getting people to pay, which is charging. You know, there's direct charging and indirect charging. Again, I'm not trying to be clever about it. It's like just people should lift their eyes a little bit, you know, lift their viewpoints, become progressively more aware. Because what happens on any technology of this nature where one is auditing a person or training a person to audit, what happens is that the guy becomes safer. And in order to look deeper within, to get out that thing which is really stopping him, he's got to be more expanded. You can't get these deep-seated viewpoints without being expanded. Now, I wish that they'd stop saying, talking about exteriorization as some unusual thing that you leave your body, because it isn't. In order to get the distance on what's going on here, you have got to be out there, and you're expanding in and out all the time that you are moving up in auditing. All the time. And but if somebody's telling you that exteriorization is that, and that you're not going to have it until this or something, don't listen. You know what you are doing every time you discover something deep that's deep inside that's been hidden from you. Know that you're there looking, but in order to do that, you've expanded way out and you've started occupying viewpoints that you left thousands, millions, trillions of years ago. And as you occupy them, so it makes it more available, this which is tied in and not here, and this loosens up. You say, boom, and it's gone. But in order to get it, you did that. When you go sailing down the time track in Dianetic auditing and things like that, what do you think you are doing? You know, when you're just expanding and expanding and expanding. Now, these are the things that I'd love you to own all the way through, because then you won't have any problem with this thing of exteriorization. It isn't a matter of getting out and staying out, or leaving your body down there that somebody's got to look after. It's a matter of just expanding, you know, sort of looking at yourself inside out and outside in all at the same time. I hope I'm not saying anything offensive here. But, you know, this is sort of like the principle of auditing. No. One other thing. I was looking at auditing. My mother said to me in South Africa a few months ago, what would you say love really is? And I've said many things about love. And I said, well, right now, the way I feel, if you love someone, it's tantamount to your willingness to audit the guy. You know, it's just your willingness to audit. And are you willing for that guy to discover everything he can discover and, if need be infinitely freer than you? Would you have that tolerance? Because that is what an auditor must have. Not that the guy's got to sit there and talk and only what you can receive. But the thing is, this tends to happen. And if you're a wise pre-clear, you are not going to overwhelm your auditor. But the thing is, to get oneself as an auditor, but you know, as an auditor, it is the whole idea is to get so that your love of that one is so much, Whoever it is, it doesn't matter. No matter what the body is like, the being is there, you know. And your love of that one is such that the guy can just go as free and as free and as free, and what's more, every time I order it, even now, I go a little bit freer. Even now, I learn from every single one who does me the privilege of sitting opposite me and allowing me to be an auditor. I used to consider it the privilege was that someone would sit opposite me and let me talk and be the auditor for me. Now it's gone more and more to the privilege that someone reaches, comes to me, and wants me to audit them. And every time, I learn something new. And this is what I learned from auditing. Just in the last 8 months. See, when I got home, I didn't say I was going to audit, I didn't say I was going to do anything. I just wanted to be away so that I could look and handle whatever auditing I needed and all my friends across the world telepathically, because it's quite easy for me to do that now. And I did a lot of telepathic auditing and a lot of reaching to people and so on, so that I never really was off the scene, although my body was in the far corner of Africa. And people just said they wanted auditing. Would I audit them? They heard, they gradually got around that I had got back and so on. And I said, yes, anyone who reached, I've always said, certainly if anyone reaches. I stood in this room on the 19th of March, 1966, as the one and only clear in the world at that time. And I said to the people here, many of them were old-timers who had come to see whether Ron Hubbard had really created a clear or not. And they were sitting there, very skeptical to start off with, but then finally they accepted me, which was very kind of them. Anyway, and I said to them at that time, I feel that I have reached a stage where I will never have to reject any sort of flow directed towards me, no matter what. No matter how hostile, no matter how loving, I will never have to reject it again. I will be able to receive it and channel it, receive it and channel it. So if somebody asks me for auditing, and it's physically possible for me to do it, I'll do it. It's a reach. But if I couldn't, I would channel them where it's possible, you see. So whilst I was doing this auditing, I was looking. I knew that there was something out. This is not a sense of judgment, something. Because I had told Ron something about 2 years ago when I was doing the Class A course. And I haven't seen it out yet. He might have put it out, but I haven't seen it out. There's a point. And it became so. As I was watching these guys, watching what was going on, seeing them in their own universes, seeing what they were releasing from, I suddenly realized this. If I had been wandering through trillions of years with a little service facsimile like, people never understand what they do. Say I have been, you see. I've had this service facsimile, which is a computation by which you make yourself right and others wrong. And say, I've just been wandering through trillions of years with such a service facsimile, all nicely, you know, sort of justified and motivated and so on. And I have, in that due course, connected with trillions and trillions and trillions of beings in various types of bodies over the years. I have been connected to them with a service facsimile. People never understand what they do. So now I'm sitting in the year 1970, and I am receiving auditing. And the auditor has made it so safe for me that I suddenly have got enough confront to look at and discover that I have walked through trillions of years with a service facsimile of this nature. I bring it out, I look at it, I laugh, and I free myself from it. And I'm free from it for the first time in trillions of years, say. What do you think happens to all the trillions of beings that I have been connected to whilst I had it? Each one of them is released from being connected to me with a service facsimile. So you could see quite conceivably that in that one release I have made, there are trillions of states of release made. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Right. So every time when I finish my auditing sessions now, I say to the guys, put it in as an ending of session. In this session, number of states of release made, is it units, tens, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions, thousands of millions, billions? And invariably ends up in the trillions. And the guy sitting there saying, trillions, trillions, and you should watch what happens on that meter. And you know, but can you see, over all these years of auditing, the unacknowledged states of release? They're right from the beginning. All of these have been happening and been unacknowledged. And if you just sit there in a chair and acknowledge, I've made trillions, and suddenly your awareness spreads to trillions, and in a flash you see the trillions of beings, they're scattered across the universe, you see, and there's a flick and a flick and a flick as you acknowledge it, and they no longer have that connection with you. They now are connected to you lighter, freer. And they're released from that thing that you were connected to them with. And, you know, that was just something, but I did it out of just doing auditing, so I learned. Audit some more if you want to learn some more. Audit some more. Come and get trained. You know, it's the most exciting thing because I'm not standing here trying to sell it at all. What I'm telling you, it's one of the most exciting activities I know. And it's one of the most rewarding because this is the way you learn and learn and learn. You learn through being audited, certainly. But you learn infinitely more when you are there and actually have to observe the right action to take for the guy you are auditing in the next split second, say. Because you see all of this going on, you say, what's going on? There's something that I acknowledge, because you can see this sort of floating bits and pieces of something that the guy has released himself from, but something hasn't been acknowledged. And suddenly, ah, that's what's not being acknowledged. You know, the guy is all the recipients at the other end, who are now freed from that. Anyway, I just thought that that was one of my exciting things that I wanted to pass on. Because, you know, in no time at all, you could see how fast one could really clear the planet when people begin to acknowledge that, because it's the sort of thing that is actually happening. It's no mystery, it's not extrasensory perception. It's not specifically telepathic. It is happening. And it happens all the time, but if it's not acknowledged, the being at the other end continues, compulsively maybe, to mock it up, to mock it up. And the guy sitting here knows he's freed himself from it, but he doesn't actually acknowledge that he's freed the others from being connected to him with that. So in relation to others, he still mocks up that thing. And it can happen in due course that he marks it up for himself again because he really hasn't freed the others from it in his acknowledgement. Therefore, he requires to use it some more. So he brings it back again and marks it all up again. Does that make sense? So you can see in relation to the mind the way things go. Now, he's free, and in this moment he might be free of it for a day, a week, a month, a year, until, because he hasn't acknowledged the freedom in others or others haven't seen the change in him, he begins to feel he hasn't really changed that much. And so he puts it back again because that was the safe way to operate. Anyway, thank you very much for being here so far. I think the lunch break is from 11:30 to 1. And I'll see you this afternoon. Thank you very much for listening to me. Thank you.